carry our burden and be victorious. If you were in a city in the Roman Empire, this would be a scene that most people would have seen at least a few times in their life, especially a city like Jerusalem. There'd be crowds along the main street, and you see some poor, wretched person dragging a giant stake and probably Roman soldiers sticking him with spears and hitting him with whips if he didn't move fast enough, dragging it through the main street of the city. Actually, there are people who enjoy watching hangings, lynchings, and stonings, so some of the people probably would consider it entertainment, but others would be very sad. He dragged it through the streets of the city till they come to the spot probably outside the city where the man would be crucified, probably hang on that stake for a day, day and a half. And, of course, the point of that whole thing was to terrorize the citizenry. He probably went through a trial and was convicted of treason to the empire. Or there could be some other crimes. Usually normal first-degree murder didn't get that, but maybe he murdered some high government official or whatever, and they get that treatment. So when Christ referred to this, the people in Jerusalem were familiar with what he meant. And whether we translate the word styro, stake, or cross, we know what he meant. So let's go to Luke 14, but there's a point to my bringing up what the people in Jerusalem would have been familiar with. Luke 14, and they probably saw at least a few executions, and people in the Roman Empire seemed, looking at the entertainment in the Colosseum, they seemed to like gory violence, so I can imagine that big crowds watch this sort of thing. Luke 14, verse 27. Luke 14, verse 27. Christ says to the crowd of people that are crowding in and they're really impressed with Christ, and he says to them, "Whosoever does not bear his cross or stake and come after me cannot be my disciple." And they were familiar with someone dragging this stake through the streets before they got crucified. And of course, the Roman Empire did that to terrorize people, so they were afraid, you know, to disobey the empire, you know, not pay their taxes, you know, rebel against the emperor, etc. And you'll even see in the book of Acts sometimes when they think they've done something to offend the empire, the officials all get frightened. You'll notice that in the book of Acts when Paul said, "Hey, I'm a Roman citizen and you beat me without a trial." Well, get scared because there's a reason to be afraid of the empire. Well, each of us have to carry our burden across the finish line to be victorious. Obviously, most people are not going to go through what Christ went through. He was flogged nearly to death and then had to drag the stake and then go through crucifixion. So that's not the kind of burden that most of us will carry. Let's look at the context and see the kind of burdens that most of us will have to carry. Verse 25 and 26. Luke 14. And there went great multitudes with him. He was very popular. By the way, if people say that, "Oh, the Jews hated Christ," that's actually not true. The Jewish people loved him, and that made the leaders all the more jealous and frightened of him. The Jewish people loved him. It's their leadership that didn't like him. They were scared to death he was going to replace them. And, of course, he could have if God had wanted that, but that wasn't God's will. Anyway, great multitudes went him, and he turned and said unto them, "If any man come to me and hate not his father, mother, wife..." Now, you realize that we have to honor our parents. He's not really saying to hate your parents. Your better translation will have love less. Anyway, you'll get the point in a minute. "Mother and wife, children and brethren, sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple." What he's saying is, your burden might be that some of your close relatives, wives, parents, brothers and sisters, will come down hard on you if you become a follower of mine, and you have to be willing to carry that burden all the way across the finish line. And, you know, that's very tough. You can lose some good friends, and they're going to pressure you to reject the newfound truths that you found. And some people can put hard pressure on, and let's face it, That can be really tough on a lot of people. They might say something like, what do you mean you're not keeping Easter and Halloween anymore? Are you crazy? Have you joined some weird cult? What's wrong with you? Or, you know, words to that effect. You're keeping Saturday for Sunday? Have you lost your mind? Sound familiar? Those are the kind of pressures you're going to receive. You're in a cult. And I understand. I mean, I think I understand. Actually, you know, there's another way that you can view this, another way you can look at it. If they didn't love you, they wouldn't care. Does that make sense? If they didn't love you, they wouldn't care that you're... Now, you're not going into a cult. And we can prove the things that we're doing are Bible-based. It's what Christ taught. This is the Christ's true Sabbath. But they don't know that. They're still blinded because they're, you know, listening to the mainstream world, which is into all those things. If they didn't love you, they wouldn't want to grab you back. So you can take it as an indirect compliment, if that makes any sense. But don't give in to the pressure. And I predict that in that, say, great white throne resurrection, like Mike Garrett said, I think some of you saw that in the tape we played 6 months back. He said that he's going to be there when his parents, close relatives are resurrected. He was saying somewhere in that Wabash Valley in Indiana. And they're going to be proud of you that you're in God's family. You made it through the first resurrection. Because they'll soon be taught the truth and that you made it and that you didn't listen to them. They'll be proud of you then. But now they're going to put pressure on us and other people in the community to give in, to drop your burden, to not carry your cross across the finish line. They want you to fold under the pressure. And Christ said very clearly, we cannot be his disciples if you're not willing to love less all those people that are dear to us. And that's pretty much what he said, just straightforwardly. That's what he said. We will not be in God's family. We will not be in God's kingdom if we do that. And remember, if we make it to God's family, we'll be at the top of God's family, because it says the first resurrection is the best resurrection. It's the best one. Not that the others aren't good, but it's the best. Going on, verse 27, whosoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, now he's going to further explain what he means by counting the cost. For which of you, verse 28, intending to build a tower, sits not down first and counts the cost, whether you have sufficient to finish it. In other words, you're going to build a building, you don't have enough money to finish it, it's half built, you run out of money, that's going to be embarrassing. Less happily, after he's laid the foundation, is not able to finish it, all that behold it begins to laugh at him. You started this big building and you don't have the money? What planning? Saying this man began to build and was not able to finish it. Or what king goes to war against another king, sits not down first and consults, you know, with all his military advisors and others, whether he be able with 10,000 to meet another army with twice as many soldiers, 20,000. Usually what they do, as he says in verse 32, or else while the other is yet a great way off, he sends an ambassador, desires conditions of peace. Hey, we would rather not go to war. What tribute do I have to pay to avoid this war? And usually that's what happens. So likewise, whosoever he be of you that forsakes not all that he has, he cannot be my disciple. Now, we're not saying you have to give all your money to the church or any crazy stuff like that. But what Christ is saying is, whatever burden Christ puts on you, you have to be willing to carry it over the finish line. We may not know what that burden is. And I think this is an important message as the years go on. Because as I looked at America losing its good credit rating, which, by the way, did you know Alexander Hamilton, the first treasurer, and I guess the number one assistant to George Washington, said America should always have good credit, cash available, and... well, just good credit and, you know, that sort of strong currency, which America did and was able to buy up things like Florida and Louisiana Purchase, Alaska, which you probably all know about. for the first time in American history, America's credit's been downgraded. Now, you're going to say, well, that could be solved if they just get the budget together and bring down the deficit as a percentage of the GDP, all of that. But it's significant. Because looking at the politicians, I don't think they can do it. I don't think they have the will. And it would take. What I'm saying is, we may be one step closer to the decline of America and the rise of the beast and the false prophet to fill that power vacuum and the return of Christ. I realize there's several steps, so it's not going to happen tomorrow. But as we get closer to that reality, we have to be willing to make the commitment to God. You're willing to even lose family members, good friends, maybe a big important job. You're willing to give that up for the sake of the gospel in Christ. The rewards are worth it. You know, Paul said that the things of this world are just dung compared to what we have in store for us. Or, in at least in some of our cases, we'll get the reward when Christ comes back or when we pass away. Because when we pass away, in the next instant of our memory, we'll wake up and we'll be in God's kingdom. So if you pass away in Christ, that's a good thing. And we resurrect it, and I honestly believe we'll be so happy that we were victorious, that we hung in there to the end. Let's go to 1 John 3. So in that context, I mean, this message that Christ put in Luke 14 is an important message that we need to really think about. 1 John 3, 1 and 2. I know we read this a lot, but it's a verse that we need to just keep in mind because probably it will be, at least in some ways, it's likely to get harder to stick with the truth and not easier. I wish I could say that's not going to be the case, but it probably is. 1 John 3, verse 1. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us that we should be called the sons of God. Therefore, the world knoweth us not, because it knew him not. Now, the word sons of God, people think, well, that's just a figurative expression. But look at the next verse. It's more than just a figurative expression. Beloved, now are we the sons of God, because we're begotten when you're baptized. And it does not yet appear what we shall be. But we know that when he shall appear, when Christ's second coming, or we're resurrected at his second coming, we shall be like him. Now, what does it mean to be like him? Just like baby tigers are like big tigers, and baby elephants are like big elephants. We shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. You realize you can't look at God. Even when Moses went on Mount Sinai, God had to protect him in various ways and clefts of mountains. He only got to see the backside of God. He still glowed even with that. But he couldn't look God in the face because God's power is so great, I guess he would have burned ashes. We'll be able to look at God because we'll be like God. We'll be the same thing. You'll be a member of God's family. I like the expression baby gods, but maybe if you don't like that, whatever you like. Think about that. That's kind of a member of God's family. You'll be like him. You'll be able to look at God eye to eye and whatever that's like. And if you go to Revelation 2:27 and several other verses in that area, it says that those of us in the first resurrection will rule the world with a rod of iron. That means you're going to have authority. You're not just going to say, well, now I'm going to go to heaven and shuffle harp music for the next 10,000 years. We're going to actually straighten out this world, which needs a lot of straightening out, in a kind, appropriate way, of course. And there's so much mess in the world that, you almost read a couple newspapers and they're shooting them down in Syria. There's all kinds of mess going on. But I want to look at one example that we've been going through in our Bible study, and that example is Daniel. Because Daniel is an example of someone who has, if you think of a stake on your back, whatever burden God put on him, he carried it across the finish line. I want to start in Daniel 1. Let's put ourselves in the position that Daniel was in Daniel 1. He probably was 16, 17, or 18 at what you might call the emperor's college to be one of his advisors. But these emperors were cruel. You make them mad and off with your head. I mean, literally, and the people in charge. Like the eunuch that was in charge of them said, hey, I could lose my head if you all don't look healthy, and you could too. So we're talking about serious ramifications. And we assume Daniel and his friends recognized that they were violating God's food laws and probably the idol laws too. And I'm just assuming the context, but it's no doubt true. They were eating meat that had with blood in it, maybe blood pudding. They were eating unclean meats. They were drinking wine that was too sweet. And a lot of these things were offered to idols. Now, he was a prisoner with his life on the line. What an excuse! You think about an excuse to eat pork chops and ham. So look at the excuse I got. Well, they might kill me if I don't eat it. What an excuse! Or maybe it was lobster or crab or shrimp smothered in butter. Or escargot. That's a great French delicacy. It's this giant snail, in case you don't know. And you crack it open with these nice little special forks and pull out the snail. And I guess they cook it in butter and oil and sugar, and it's supposedly good. It's very expensive if you go to a French restaurant. Think about that. You get to have crab, squirrel, escargot, maybe rabbits, possibly some other exotic foods. And certainly catfish, of course, and wine, more wine, and very, very sweet wine. Now, think of the excuse. Well, I had to eat it. They want to kill me. I'm better off to eat all that stuff than be dead. Think of the excuse the man had. But he stood for the truth. He did it in a polite, nice way and said, just give us water and vegetables. By the way, we know from Daniel 10, which we talked about Daniel's they call it the Daniel fast, where he gave up wine and meat for 3 weeks. That proves that Daniel did eat meat and did drink wine. In case anyone says, well, he was a vegetarian. No, that was not the issue. He gave up those things because they violated God's law. He knew it. And you can just imagine what an emperor who's got vast amounts of money, I think the guy in charge says, look, this food is, people die practically for the emperor to have this food. It's brought from far away, probably from exotic seabeds and faraway forests, and people catching all kinds of weird animals. And by the way, if it weren't for God's law, people would know what's clean and unclean to eat. You just can't tell based on human taste. When I was in the Orient, mice and cats were big, and so were dogs. They're big on the menu. I mean, when I say they're big, they are big. One place I was, they said dogs are our favorite food. They're chewy, sweet, and rubbery. I remember that because that's the kind of thing you remember. And I guess with sauces and stuff, you can make anything taste good. And let's admit it, pork chops do taste good, right? And so does ham. Some of you are saying, no, not really. Okay. I guess some of that's maybe a matter of taste. But he had every excuse, but Daniel said, I'm going to do the right thing and take my chances that God will get me through it. And God got him through it. He was healthier and sharper than the other young students eating all that garbage and drinking all that wine. And it probably actually propelled him to greater success, as we all know. And in Daniel 6, it talks of Daniel and the lion's den. Let's just go to Daniel 6. The whole story is very well known, but I want to just talk about Daniel crossing the finish line for one brief moment here. And I think Daniel 6 is a great example of someone who is doing the right thing. And in Daniel 6, we can pick it up in verse 8, Daniel 6, 8. And now, O king, establish the decree, sign the writing, that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which you cannot alter their law. And in that law, they couldn't worship anyone but the emperor for 30 days. Think of how that would appeal to the vanity of the emperor. But, of course, these men who devised it were political rivals of Daniel. They were jealous of his success, and the whole thing was a plot to get him. Daniel was such a good man that the only way we can get him, we can't get him on corruption or bribes. The only way we can get him has to do with his religion. Otherwise, this man is squeaky clean. That's a great compliment to Daniel. For King Darius signed the writing and decree. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he understood what was going on. He went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem. By the way, when Solomon, his big prayer and a big celebration, dedicated God's temple, as part of the prayer, Solomon said, and I think God replied back in a vision to him, that whenever the Israelites stumble or fall, and they pray toward this temple, I think that's how the Muslims got their imitation of praying to Mecca, to bow to the east. They kind of take it to the extreme. That's where they got the idea from. When they pray toward this temple, because figuratively God is there, he will hear their prayers. It is possible, some commentaries believe, that Daniel was in the process of praying that Jeremiah's 70 weeks prophecy would be triggered, because the way it's written up, if the people prayed toward the temple and repented, God would bring the Jewish people, the Jewish nation, back into existence after 70 years. And Daniel probably thought, isn't this a coincidence? When I'm really praying a lot for my people to come back, I'm praying toward the temple as instructed, they come up with this plot to stop me from praying. Now look at it from Daniel's point of view. Daniel could say, I could hide in an inner closet and just pray less and hide, make shorter prayers so nobody can possibly see me, and I'll still be praying, won't I? I think Daniel said in his heart, if I'm seeming to God to be compromising because I fear the world, God is not going to respect this prayer. It won't have as much power if I let the world cower me out of praying. In other words, Daniel believed that any compromise with worldly power would make his prayers less effective. Most of us would say, well, just pray secretly. Stay out of trouble. But Daniel immediately did the same thing he always did toward Jerusalem. And we assume his window was open to the east, and people who were spying on him, you know they were watching him, can see it. So with his window being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did a fourth time. Notice, he even thanked God, though he knew he was going to face some persecution. He thanked God. You think of Paul when he was thrown in prison with Silas and apparently beaten with rods. And in the inner prison, they sang hymns thanking God that they were worthy to suffer for the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, that's spiritual strength and power. Well, Daniel did that. And, of course, we know the story. God sent angels. And he was with those lions as safe as you could be with a bunch of bodyguards, using the lion's mane for a pillow, maybe, but whatever. The lions didn't touch him. Walked out of there the next day. And the men that accused him, the emperor finally figured it out and was mad. He had them pushed in, must have been let down on a ramp or something. They didn't even touch the ground before the lions had ripped them to shreds. So it wasn't that the lions weren't hungry, just that, angel said, you guys have no appetite. You love this guy. You're not going to bite him. And that was it. God performed a great miracle, and Daniel actually got more political power, and his enemies were the ones that got taken out of the way. And the main point is, Daniel was victorious. He took his burden across the finish line, and he was victorious. And, of course, so were his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, with the fiery furnace. Very similar. They had the nerve to say to the emperor, who wasn't used to people saying no, they said, well, look, we're not going to bow to this pagan idol. Our God can rescue us, but even if he doesn't, we're still not going to do it. The emperor was like, you're kidding me. Nobody says that to me. He made him heat the furnace up hotter, and they were victorious. It's a great victory. Don't you believe that when Daniel took that stand to pray with the windows open, God was happy with Daniel? God was, I don't know if proud is the appropriate word. Let's say he was pleased with Daniel. And same with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And the same when they resisted eating blood pudding and, escargot and all those exotic foods that were probably in the mix somewhere. God was happy with them. Now, you and I have smaller burdens. We don't have such spectacular burdens. Maybe a few people from this church, maybe in the future, will do spectacular things. But we don't have big, spectacular burdens. But we still want to be victorious over whatever burdens we have. Going to Daniel 10, verse 11. Daniel 10, 11. It says, and the angel touched Daniel, verse 10, Daniel 10, 11. He said to me, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto you, and stand upright. For unto you I am now sent. and then go on to verse 19. And he said, O man greatly beloved. Think about that. O man greatly beloved, fear not. And when you read the whole context of it, it's clear that God greatly loved Daniel and was happy with Daniel's in the Babylonian Empire and the other empire that came after that, Persian Empire, that Daniel was victorious over threats. O man greatly beloved. Wouldn't it be nice? I mean, we're not going to be as great as Daniel or David or anything like that. But for God to say something like that about us. Oh, man, greatly beloved. Daniel was victorious. Fear not. Peace be unto you. Be strong. Yea, be strong. God would say to us, be strong. Be strong. When he had spoken unto me, I was strengthened and said, let my Lord speak, for thou hast strengthened me. And then he tells him about the various prophecies. But I believe that even though our burdens are smaller, we can be victorious too. Let's go to Luke 16. We're going to read two sets of scriptures. I want to just make a point about even though our burdens are smaller, it's still important. God wants us to be victorious. Luke 16, 10. I'll start in verse 9. Just get a little context. And he said unto me, make to yourselves friends of mammon of unrighteousness, that when you fail, they may receive you an everlasting habitation. In other words, the parable was make friends of the right people. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. He that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. In other words, he's saying, make friends of God and show God that even in little things, maybe under little persecutions from friends, relatives, or whatever pressures we're under, we remain faithful. God knows we'll be faithful when he gives us greater power in the world tomorrow. Let's go to Luke 19, 17. Luke 19, 17. He said unto him, well, thou good servant, because you have been faithful in a very little, has thou authority over 10 cities. Then he goes, gives others. In other words, even though our trials may be smaller than Daniel's and all the great heroes of the Bible, Jeremiah, even though our trials may be smaller, if we remain faithful, God will reward us with a lot more power in the future. Maybe someone here will be over Carbondale. You got a tough job. Over SIU or whatever. But whatever you think, or maybe Chicago. Oh, that'd be a tough job, I tell you. But at any rate, but I'm going to add a little bit extra to this. Part of our smaller burden will be helping and encouraging each other. Because, in Hebrews 10, well, let's go to Hebrews 10. Take a quick look at it. I know we're familiar with it, but let's just take a quick look at it anyway. Hebrews 10. We'll pick it up in verse 24. Hebrews 10, 24. And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and good works. In other words, doing positive things. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. In other words, you don't really show up at church much. As a manner of some is, but exhorting one another so much the more as you see the day approaching. In other words, now that you see that we're getting into financial problems, which will eventually make America have to pull back militarily and other things as well, you see prophecy starting to fulfill, at least that's what the church always thought would happen. We should be there encouraging each other all that much more. Now, I want to tell you a little corny story. This little league coach grabs one of the kids on the team, and he says, "Do you know what it means to be a team player?" And the young man said, "Yes, yes, coach, yes, I do." "You know what it means to cooperate for victory for the team?" "Yes, yes." "You know that we must win as a team?" "Yes." "You don't want to make things harder for the team. Do you understand that, son?" "Yes, coach, yes." And the boy says, "Yes, yes." "Well, when an ump calls a strike, you don't want to argue with him and curse him out, do you?" No, sir. "When he calls you out at first base, you do not want to curse him and his entire lineage, do you?" The boy says, "Yes." "Do you really understand?" "Yes, I understand. Now, go over to the stands and explain that to your dad." We were talking about how we saw this one hockey game that our son played in, and we screamed and hollered so much. And it was a ton of fun. Parents screaming is really not such an unusual thing. Anyway, but the point of that is we should try to shoulder each other's burden a little bit by encouraging each other. You know, if the parents get on the umpire, that's going to make him biased toward the other team. And they make a number of bad decisions. I saw one on TV where they called the guy safe, and the catcher blocked him from the plate by 2 feet. It was so embarrassing on replay. It was, well, umpire said, "Safe. But wait a minute. Where's his eyes?" Well, I suppose the umpire said, they got to make a quick decision. But if he hates you, you're going to get a lot more of those. The other side is safe when he's out. So we need to try to help each other. Encourage each other, because that's the battle that we face. Let's go to James 5. And there's a verse here that when you think about it, I think there's some extra that will come to us if we're able to do this. James 5, verse 19 and 20. James 5, verse 19 and 20. James 5, 19. "Brethren, if any of you do err from the truth," in other words, if you see someone fall away from the truth, some other translations are better than the King James, but if you see someone fall from the truth and you convert him, that means you bring him back. Maybe he's fallen to sin, he's fallen to alcoholism, he's being deceived by something weird, whatever it is, he's slipping back into the world, and you can encourage him and you bring him back. "Let him know that he which converts the sinner from the error of his way," or that you bring him back. I think that some translations use the term backslider. You take the backslider and you encourage him and you get him to come back. "Converts the sinner from the error of his way, shall save a soul from death," meaning the second death, "and shall hide a multitude of sins." I think what it says, God will give you some extra grace. You're going to call it extra credit. You know, like teachers, they give you extra credit. They'll give you some extra grace because you save somebody who's backsliding from going off the deep end. So I think that our burden is for us to try to carry our burden all the way across the finish line and to whatever extent we're able to encourage each other. Now, I'm not going to read James 3 through 5, but if you read through James 3 through 5, here's what he says. He says, anybody who comes to church, you should treat fairly. Because the obvious temptation, someone comes to church and he's rich. He's got beautiful clothing and he's got a gorgeous, I don't know, in today's world, maybe he's got great clothes, big car, big home, big important job, and he's socially well-connected and personable. And you treat him like, oh. And then another person comes and they're in total rags and they got nothing and they got problems that are obvious. And you treat them like, and James says you're being a judge, you're being impartial. And what he's really saying, when you go through that section, James 3 through 5, he's saying show love and encouragement to everybody in the church, regardless of their problems, regardless of their lack of money. And, of course, the opposite would be, I hate rich people, I don't even mean anybody's got money. That would be wrong, too. The law says don't be biased against the rich or for the rich. And that's in Deuteronomy. But the point is we should encourage everybody. Be nice to all the brethren, the high roller or the person who's down his luck and has got many problems. And I believe if we do that, It's like when you pray for other people, it helps you. When you do something for other people, it helps you. It's almost like the opposite of what you think. A self-centered person, my focus is going to be completely on telling God how great I am. But it might be better for you to help somebody else. I mean, obviously, be victorious yourself too. But help somebody else, and you'll get that extra grace from God. And be nice to everybody, people with problems, the people who impress you, either way. And I believe God will bless us with that extra credit of grace. And remember, to whatever our burdens are, whatever cross we have to bear, or styros or stake, big or small, drag it across the finish line. Don't give up. And I know a guy who's a really nice guy. At least this is what we heard, what he said. He drifted away from the church because he missed Christmas and giving gifts to kids and grandkids. Now, you all know that I never liked Christmas, so it was easy for me. Because they gave me such pitiful gifts at Christmas that I just resented it. You know, can you imagine getting underwear and socks for Christmas? Are you kidding me? And I'm supposed to be happy about this? He's a card little kid. But I won't go into all that now. But for some people, that's a big burden. If it's a big burden, I understand, you know, but you've got to drag it across the finish line. Don't let deceptions, relatives, friends, well, if my friend leaves the church, I got to leave too. I don't think so. But we should encourage each other, and I believe God will be very pleased with us. It would be nice at the end of our life, because of the grace of Christ and the help of God's Holy Spirit, God could say of us, as he did of Daniel, you're a man that God is well pleased with.